Issues, etc., offered post-election analysis from a variety of perspectives. Former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese.
By giving a list of the type of people that he would appoint as judges, it gave a number of people confidence that A, President Trump would be very cognizant of the importance of constitutional appointments to the court.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I am hopeful, though, that his appointees and also the Republican Congress will push for and enact protections for people who happen to have religious convictions on these matters so that they won't be simply driven out of society.
Journalist Molly Hemingway.
The media are so far removed from actual people who don't live in Washington or New York that they were unable to see what was going on, even though people were trying pretty hard to convey their feelings here.
Social critic Aaron Wolf.
If they're serious about curbing abortion, we need to hold their feet to the fire on this because they now have a signature from the president that they should be able to get. And therefore, they are without excuse when it comes to these things.
And never Trumper, Dr. Frank Beckwith.
The accusation of racism, I think, is just a cheap slur. And of course, these people can't defend themselves. And here comes Donald Trump, and he says, I'll stand by you. I will be your advocate. And it explained to me why people gravitated to this man. And it's somebody who I did not support myself, but I think I understand much better now.
Your comprehensive source for news, information, and truth, issues, etc.
During the campaign, you said that you would appoint justices who were against abortion rights. Will you appoint, are you looking to appoint a justice who wants to overturn Roe v. Wade?
So, look, here's what's going to happen. I'm pro-life. The judges will be pro-life. They'll be.
But what about overturning this law?
Well, there are a couple of things. They'll be pro-life. They'll be in terms of the whole gun situation. We know the Second Amendment, and everybody's talking about the Second Amendment, and they're trying to dice it up and change it. They're going to be very pro-Second Amendment. But having to do with abortion, if it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states. So
yeah,
it would go back to the
some
states.
Some women
and the states
won't be able to get an abortion.
No, it'll go back to the states.
By state? No, some.
Yeah. Well, they'll perhaps have to go to they'll have to go to another state.
And that's okay.
Well, we'll see what happens. It's got a long way to go, just so you understand. That has a long, long way to go.
One of the groups that's expressing fear, the LGBTQ group.
I mentioned them at the Republican National Convention. And
you did.
Everybody said, that was so great. I've been a supporter.
Well, I guess the issue for them is marriage equality. Do you support marriage equality?
It's irrelevant because it was already settled. It's law. It was settled in the Supreme Court. I mean, it's done.
So even if you appoint a judge that...
It's done. These cases have gone to the Supreme Court. They've been settled. And I'm fine with it.
That's President-elect Donald Trump speaking with Leslie Stahl of CBS's 60 Minutes about abortion and homosexual marriage. Of course, the focus there is on the court. And it sounds as though, regardless of the positions, it sounds as though a lot of people did vote for Donald Trump because of his promise to make certain Supreme Court appointments as the opportunity arose. He already has an opportunity in the vacant seat of Justice Antonin Scalia. Is that something new? And is that the best strategy when it comes to protecting the life of the unborn and protecting the idea and the practice of natural marriage? Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon, the 15th of November. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about some abortion and homosexual marriage statements made by President-elect Trump on 60 Minutes. Joining us to do so, Hadley Arkus. He's a regular guest, professor emeritus of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the natural law. Hadley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me. What an interesting array of things to be said to be put on the table here today.
I want your reaction to Donald Trump's statements there. They were kind of juxtaposed there in the way we presented them. His talking about the possibility of Roe v. Wade being overturned, but then when it came to the gay marriage ruling, the more proximate one by the Supreme Court. He said it's settled law. Can't really do anything about it. What is your reaction to that?
That's remarkable. It's a decision only 2 years old in a 5-4 decision, as opposed to Roe versus Wade, almost 44 years old. And you think, why is that unsettled? Because there's still so much contention about it. He's treating the marriage issue as settled because he seems to sense that conservatives have lost their stomach or their nerve in talking about it. We do have something on the table. We do have measures that we can bring forth in Congress, and having the political branches, Congress, take some of the first steps in countering Obergefell and just limiting that decision and a step toward overturning it. But what he's indicated is he has not much interest in it. In fact, what he indicates people seem to be missing in this exchange is that he is the political branches, in his understanding, he has nothing to say on those issues. Those are issues he'll give over to judges. So when you wonder what he's going to do for the pro-life movement, he will not speak about it. He will not get behind any measures in Congress to take the initiative in trying to limit the holding in Roe or to cut back on Roe by enlarging protections. He's indicating to us he's not going to speak about that. That's been the kind of the curious settlement that the pro-lifers have been willing to accept, within the Republican Party over the last 30 years. They say, this is not the responsibility of elected officials. We'll give you judges. And over the long run, the judges will do it. And he's not promising to overrule Roe versus Wade. He's simply promising what the conservative jurisprudence has been promising for 30-some years, which is, we'll overturn Roe versus Wade so the question goes back to the states, which means that all of Don Trump's friends in New York will have the fullest right to abortion that they enjoy today. Nothing is going to be changed there. And he's not apparently ready to get behind any measure, like the measure we've had on the table, to punish the surgeon who kills the child who survives the abortion. I mean, we had 177 Democrats vote against that move in September 2015, and it was never even mentioned in the campaign. He had no interest in it. That in recognizing that the right to abortion, as far as the Democrats understand it, is not confined to the pregnancy, but it extends to cover the right to kill the child who survives, that the right to abortion is the right to a dead baby. But the curious thing is that what you're getting from Donald Trump is exactly what we've been getting from Republican presidents and what conservative jurisprudence in the federal society has been offering it to us for the last 30 years. Nothing has changed there. But again, on this matter of the political branches, there is the sentiment in favor of marriages of one man, union of one man, is still planted deeply in the country. It can be cultivated if there's a political leadership ready to cultivate it. So, but again, I don't think he really indicates that he wants to overturn Roe versus Wade. Even if it were overturned, it would simply put things back to the states. But there's a strong sense that, a prudential sense, that people would be alarmed by the sudden overturning of Roe versus Wade, that it may be better just to keep cutting it back, removing the substance while the shell remains, and simply enlarging the protections for human life. So you can do this. In the Supreme Court, 2007, with the addition of John Roberts and Sam Alito, sustained the bill on partial birth abortion, that grisly procedure of killing a child at the point of birth. And what they were saying, in effect, is we are in business to start receiving legislation to the states extending the protections of the child in the womb. And Justice Kennedy seemed to be quite open to that move. So it's entirely possible that, as he said, this is going to take a long time. He probably means that it's going to be with a long period in which we're going to see the states enlarge protections for the unborn child. And not much is done to overrule Roe versus Wade.
So he's being entirely consistent with what the pro-life community has come to accept from Republican presidents.
It's a reflection of the fact that the pro-life community has not demanded very much.
I want to talk a little bit about just at least laying politics aside, the fact that the Supreme Court is often viewed as not only the court of final appeal, but in itself unreversible. Is that true?
Oh, no, of course not. Of course not. Not only, but you know, oh, we could go so many times that the court has reversed itself. It could be with a new deal. You know, we have these cases in the early part of the century, latter part of the 19th century, early 20th century, overturning, striking down these laws on regulating hours and wages and the minimum wage. And all of that was overturned during the days of the New Deal as the court was willing to sustain virtually anything regulating the economy under an extended view of the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause can reach any enterprise which could possibly have an effect on interstate commerce if it's dealing with products that travel interstate commerce. So we had those overturned. Of course, we had the case on racial segregation overturned with Brown versus Board. But people forget that we take the most dramatic example, the Dred Scott case from the mid-19th century. We're holding there's a constitutional right not to be deprived of one's property as a slave when entered into a territory, not a state, but a territory of the United States. Lincoln led a national movement to counter and overturn that decision. And it was done by the political branches. Congress passed a law essentially barring slavery from the Western territories, any state that may yet be created, and virtually challenging the courts. They try to strike this down and we'll move to the level of a constitutional amendment. And Lincoln, in a series of administrative decisions, just undid the Dred Scott decision. In other words, the understanding was, when you have a decision of the court that may be widely regarded as indefensible, it is not simply the business of the courts. The political branches themselves have roles to play in interpreting the Constitution, which is why, for example, we have this bill in Congress, as I said, to punish the surgeon who kills a child surviving abortion. Let's say the Congress passes that. What the Congress would be saying to the court would be, whatever you meant in Roe versus Wade, you couldn't possibly have meant what Mr. Obama thinks you meant, the right to kill a child who survives an abortion. And let's say Congress does that. It can come forth with another thing. Whatever you meant, it certainly meant to kill a child afflicted with Down syndrome or with deafness. And Congress could do this step by step. The curious thing about this is when, as this thing is discussed, we have screened out the recognition that the political branches, elected officials, President and Congress, can weigh in on these matters. And some of the politicians are really quite content to have it that way. They'd rather duck responsibility for the issues themselves and leave the responsibilities in the hands of those officials wearing robes who never have to run for re-election.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking about abortion and homosexual marriage statements made by President-elect Donald Trump on 60 Minutes. So, leaving these issues to the judges, why is that not a good way to set and shape the laws of our country? We'll answer that question with Hadley Arkus right after this.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Faith Lutheran Church and School in Plano, Texas preaches Christ crucified. Join us each Lord's Day to hear law and gospel preaching and to receive the Lord's Supper. Our classical preschool through grade 12 Lutheran school is second to none. The school serves home educators, too, with online classes in the high school. We are located at 1701 East Park Boulevard in Plano, Texas. Reach us by phone at 972-423-7448 or on the web at www.flsplano.org.
Emily finally had to face the truth. Her church choir was a mess.
Katie Schuerman from her new audiobook, House of Living Stones.
Sure, they'd managed to turn out a few decent choral offerings for Sunday worship every now and then, but their confidence and morale were presently hanging lower than pants on a wrapper.
You can purchase and download an audio version of the novel House of Living Stones at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. House of Living Stones by Katie Schuerman. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hadley Arkus is our guest, author of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of Natural Law. We're talking about some statements made recently on 60 Minutes by President-elect Donald Trump on both Roe v. Wade and Obergefell on abortion and homosexual marriage. Hadley, in a general sense here, leaving these decisions to judges, which seems to be the modus operandi on both sides of the aisle, why is this not a good way to set and shape the laws of our country?
Lincoln said in his first inaugural, can you imagine a situation in which a bare majority of a nine-member court, five people, perhaps in combination with two litigants in a private action, which could be even collusive, seven people have a private case, and this combination of five plus two, seven people, can settle the policy of the whole country, and the rest of the country has to pass a constitutional amendment to overturn it. At that moment, as Lincoln said, the people have ceased to be their own rulers. We will have passed over the right, the authority to rule the country. We would have passed it over to the hands of that eminent tribunal. We'd have put ourselves under the oligarchy of judges. Well, you know, you said the courts has the final word. It is not clear. Nothing here in the Constitution indicates that the court has the final word. And the fact, you know, the court, as we've seen in the past, the court comes up with decisions, and a number of times the political branches have cut back, pushed back, induce the court to narrow the holding, even overturn the holding. So it would be a very bad way for a republic to be ruled by putting the ultimate governing authority in the hands of five unelected judges serving for life. It was understood that even when John Marshall overturned Marbury versus Madison, he said the judges, of course, had to consider whether any law that they're being asked to judge is consistent with the underlying fundamental law. But that question is a question that has to be in front of a president or congressman who has to make a decision on the constitutionality of the act. In fact, when we did the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996, Barney Frank said at the time, I think this whole thing is unconstitutional. And I said, Congressman, you make our very point. We're asking the Congress to provide guidance for the court in interpreting the law here. And if you think it's unconstitutional, it's your obligation to vote against it on that basis. If you take a look at the system, it's not clear who has the final word. You could say it's an ongoing conversation in which the political branches may indeed engage the court in a conversation about what it has decided. So the Congress now could come back and say, Mr. Obama says that all the rights engaged in Roe versus Wade would be imperiled if you seek to punish a surgeon who kills a child who survives an abortion. And now the Congress could say, no, we would suggest to the court that nothing in Roe versus Wade should entail this right to kill a child who survives an abortion. And if they could say that, they can come back with another measure, precise and limited in the same way.
You're really arguing here for a return to the constitutional process wherein the legislature actively and the executive branch actively participate in the making of positive law that addresses issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, those kinds of things, rather than saying, hey, it's in the court's hands, and there it remains?
Well, I'm arguing for is the Constitution, the constitutional arrangements, as they were understood during the days of the Civil War with Lincoln and slavery, how they were understood in the time of the New Deal, when the political branches did indeed press on the courts to overturn or limit their decisions. I mean, when did this stop? You know, it must have become with Brown versus Board and the soon place when the time when the court was invested with a certain kind of majesty or sanctity, that somehow the decisions of the court are beyond question or challenge for the political branches. Remember, Lincoln's position was, if the court decides that Dred Scott is a slave, then we are not going to form a mob and undo the judgment of the case. But if we're not persuaded of the principle of the case, that slavery is a legitimate form of property, that black people cannot be citizens of the United States, we are not obliged to act on that principle in any other measure that comes before us. Look, this was all clear. This was clear to an earlier generation. In fact, the Democrats use this understanding now all the time in trying to restrict things that decisions of the court that they don't approve of. So it's a curious kind of screening out of our history, of the logic of the Constitution and our constitutional history, which gives us this notion that somehow the Supreme Court pronounced the judgment on same-sex marriage, pronouncing that anyone who opposes it, informed by several thousand years of history, informed by the logic that brings up the marriage of a man and woman as the most defensible form of marriage, that somehow the Supreme Court declares all of that simply to be some kind of irrational animus supported by no reason, that declaration, according to Donald Trump, settles the matter? It does not at all settle the matter. What he's telling you is that the people he senses as he goes around the country that people just don't have the nerve to talk about this anymore. They'd rather just let it go than talk about it. But we're talking about one of the most fundamental institutions in the country that goes to the matrix of the laws. You might ask yourself then this time, what does it say about a people that we'd rather talk about the economy rather than talk about questions such as what human beings are under the protections of the law and what constitutes the terms of principle in which people come together in a relation of commitment for the begetting and nurturing of children? That somehow those questions that run to the heart of human life and to the heart of the terms on which we stand in the relation to one another in this country, those questions that run to the heart of things are things we can no longer discuss in public because they're too heated, too contentious, or because people are not confident that they could summon the words that they need when the question arises. It means we're out of practice. But of course, as Lincoln showed, forgive me for citing Lincoln again, remember Lincoln said, we can't talk about slavery anyway. We can't talk about it in the churches. It's too controversial, too explosive. It's too explosive in politics. It's the question that runs to the heart of the things, and yet there was no place to talk about it. What Lincoln showed is that the function, the office, the mission of a political man at times is to teach people how to talk about something important that people are not comfortable in talking about. And that is the kind of leadership we have to recover. We don't have it in Donald Trump, but he's rescued us. He's given us a certain deliverance from the things that would have been done in our law on abortion and marriage and the transgendered if Hillary Clinton had taken over the presidency and she were appointing the judges that were filling out those lower federal courts.
Are you saying, Hadley, that it is part, if not the constitutional duty, it is part of the responsibility, generally speaking, of the chief executive, the president of the United States, to initiate conversations about these very important issues in the protection of life, the nature of the family and of marriage? It's the president's responsibility to start that conversation, or at least to participate in it.
Well, he has the chief focus. The focus of the country is preeminently on a man in political authority. And people in political authority usually have the quality of what this used to be called sort of an authoritative type. I mean, they're an example of the kind of people we so admire that we lift into a position of public prominence. But again, what the lesson that Lincoln taught is that the real purpose of a political man is to come to a judgment of those issues that are truly are central. They may not be congenial, may not be the easiest to talk about, but what are the issues that really are important to preserving the character of our life under this American regime? But Donald Trump, that's not the angle he takes on statecraft. He doesn't try to figure out, reflect on the question of what issues are more or less central. He'll simply talk about the things he likes to talk about. He thinks we can make America great again by getting better trade deals, reviving employment, and that's all very, very apt and very true, to take the country seriously again as a real polity, not a hotel where people check in and out, but a real political order with moral commitments and moral demands. There's nothing trivial about that, but he doesn't have a mind that really runs down to reflect about the issues that really do stand at the core of things, you know, such as the issue of, again, who is the human being? Who is a human being who's protected by in the law? But you're right. He has an unparalleled position, not readily emulated, copied by anyone else, to start the conversation. What he wants to talk about will suddenly become a matter of conversation overnight, just as when Ronald Reagan, years ago, State of the Union speech, put out the point that fetuses can feel pain. He just put that out, and it started a wide-ranging discussion in the country, late-night television, so on. Yes, Trump has this capacity. He's already shown he can stir conversation on many subjects, but he has also indicated he doesn't really have an interest in stirring conversation on these things. They really do run to the core of the kind of people we are.
What would a pro-life president do? As the model that you've painted for us here is of pro-life president after pro-life president, essentially delegating the future of these issues and the conversation to appointed judges. What, if he were to abandon that model, what would a pro-life president do about the issue of life? What would he actually do about marriage?
The sort of thing we have, sort of asking for the president's Bushes to do, which they didn't do, which is start a conversation by offering something very limited, like the draft I wrote for the first George Bush, to say, if the court is returning the matter to the political arena, we need a conversation. The matter has been governed by the courts for so long. We need a conversation as to how we legislate. The other side says abortion is not infanticide. They're willing to protect the child at some point. So let's invite them to tell us when they're willing to begin that protection of the child. And if nothing else, we'll say, how about birth? Because we've had a federal judge tell us that even a child who survives an abortion is not a person protected by the law. Can't we not just begin there? Well, that's where I would have had President Bush's begin, and neither one of them would step into that to start that conversation at a point where they could have commanded the assent of even pro-choicers in states like Connecticut, New Jersey. At the very least, you can start with something very modest, a bill on the table to protect the child born alive who survives an abortion. And we say, if you accept that, then we'll start step by step with measures comparable to that most people in the country agree with. I mean, the survey showed that like 60% of the country would oppose about 90% of the abortions performed under Roe versus Wade. We could just start working incrementally along that list. In other words, a president could begin a conversation by inviting people who are pro-choice to join people who are pro-life in some very limited measures, showing a point of agreement, but planting premises. Because as we said, if you accept this notion about the child who survives the abortion, we'll come back and ask you, what's different about that same child 5 minutes earlier, 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months earlier? You know where this is going to go. But planting the premise and raising the question is dynamic. It's instructive. The president can be a teacher in a very modest and very gentle way. And what's remarkable is how unwilling executives are, even when it's been costless politically to do it. You know, no strain. And what it seems reveals in the case of the Bushes is that they came from a circle where it was considered just tacky to talk about this question. They don't like people who talk about the pro-life issue. Well, again, I guess, Todd, what you're going to get from me is once more, there are ways of talking about this, and what a political man can do at his best is teach people a gentle way of talking about important things that we often are quite unwilling to talk about.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're talking about some abortion and homosexual marriage statements made by President-elect Donald Trump on 60 Minutes. When we come back, that incremental legislative approach, if that becomes law through the president's signature, does that law have a teaching function for those principles for future voters?
The Church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Does the gospel free you to do what you want? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Better Than Good, Failed Attempts to Improve on the Gospel. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer's spiritual journey from Roman Catholicism and American Evangelicalism to Confessional Lutheranism, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues Etc. On this Tuesday afternoon, November the 15th, we're talking with Hadley Arkus of Amherst College about abortion and homosexual marriage, President-elect Donald Trump, Roe v. Wade, and Obergefell. Hadley, you spoke before the break about that incremental legislative approach. If that legislation can get a president's signature, can that law have a didactic function for instilling those pro-life and pro-marriage principles in the electorate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think my hunch is that if you keep cutting back, it's what we used to call the art of overruling. You just keep restricting it, and until one day you say, you know, there's something quite wrong about this whole thing. You know, Byron White, who's one of the dissenters in Roe versus Wade, startled Justice John Paul Stevens once by saying that he too could accept Roe versus Wade if we were put on the same plane as all those other decisions that apparently were taken to sum up to Roe versus Wade. For example, a constitutional right to marry. But as he pointed out, the right to marry never meant that the freedom to marry may not be restricted for many plausible reasons. An age of consent, barring incestuous unions, confining marriage to adults who are of the opposite sex. There are many grounds in which the people who proclaimed a right to marry thought that that right to marriage could be quite plausibly, justly restricted. And White was saying, you do that with abortion, I could accept Roe versus Wade if it were understood in the same way. That there are many plausible restraints put on that freedom to order an abortion. And once that were done, if we started doing that step by step, we'd probably work our way essentially back to the state of the law before Roe versus Wade, which was that perhaps women could be able to get an abortion on those conditions, quite rare today, now even rare, when the life of a woman could be endangered by the pregnancy. But you could get all that going, and Roe versus Wade could stand there until it is gradually narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. And the remarkable thing to me is how little progress we've made in that very simple project, and how little initiative has been shown by our conservative leaders in Congress, with the exception of people like Rick Santorum or the remarkable Trent Franks. But it's there. It's been part of the American system all along. It's simply a matter of somebody just having the wit and the nerve to get it going, to start speaking about these questions again. Trent Franks in the judiciary is one man. He's the one who did bring forth that bill to punish the man who killed the child who survived the abortion. And he thought that that issue would really have an effect on this election. And he's just absolutely as astonished as I am that Donald Trump and the conservatives never found any reason to mention it, even though it was putting the question of abortion on the hardest side for their opponents, the hardest ones for their opponents to deal with. And the remarkable thing is that people in the media, Fox News, never picked this up. It's because the vast engines of research and the networks, the media, never learned about this bill. And even the Catholics and Catholic commentators in the media, Brett Baer, Megyn Kelly, Bill O'Reilly, were not even aware of this thing. It's remarkable screening that has taken place here. But once again, you know, we're talking about, sometimes we said the task here is to impart speech to the mute, to teach people that they really do have the capacity to speak to these things, and it's not as hard as they may think. And once you start doing it, you find that people say, well, I agree with that. Of course. Of course we should be protecting a child who survives an abortion. What is this?
Does it also explain why the advocates of abortion have proven so absolutist? In other words, they will not brook any restrictions on abortion. They view every, even the most minor restriction on abortion, as threatening the very core of what they consider to be that right itself. Is it because they understand how that conversation could slowly but surely overturn?
Exactly. That was at work. When we did that bill to protect the child who survived the abortion, we started in year 2000, and 2002 we enacted it. And when we did the hearings, I led the hearings in the House. When we did the hearings, some of our friends, like Henry Hyde, couldn't really understand what we're going to gain by doing something so modest. And they're absolutely astonished when the National Organization of Women, or NARO at the time, the feminists, were adamantly against this. And what was revealed in that moment is that our adversaries understood our bill more clearly than our own friends, because they understood the principle that lay at the heart of the thing, that once we conceded that that was a child who survived the abortion, it was a child, had been a child 5 minutes, 5 weeks earlier, once we planted that premise, it was going to be very hard to keep their positions from unraveling. So they will simply hold to the position that, yeah, you mean well here, but we have laws on homicide to protect children already, unless, of course, they're involved in abortion. We have these things, and what you're going to do, what you are doing, is taking a first step with the intention of overturning the right to abortion itself. You're absolutely right. That is our intention. But are you saying that for the sake of preserving that right to abortion, you are willing to accept this infanticide outright of killing a child that is no longer has its interests, encumbering the interests of the mother? The mother is free of a pregnancy she didn't want, and yet you think she still has the right to kill the child, and you'd rather grant her that right than do anything that could unravel that precious right to an abortion. That is their position, and the remarkable thing is they get away with it, that the people who come out of the best schools in the country don't seem to have the wit for deliberating about the question in a principled way, and the people in the media don't know how to challenge this, and are entirely credulous themselves in listening to this, and perhaps even, you know, going along with it, not recognizing what may be bizarre in the claim that we must accept infanticide outright as the only way of preserving that right to abortion. But in a curious way, of course, it's a deep concession that they're killing human beings all along, that there is no clear separation of infanticide because we're killing the same child. So what they are recognizing really is that is the same child being killed, and that what they call abortion is in fact infanticide by another name.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. When we come back, we've had a 40-year lesson in advocating for the protection of the unborn under the umbrella of Roe v. Wade. Is there a lesson for those who want to advocate for marriage under Obergefell? Stay tuned.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at EdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Christians, young and old, are increasingly pressured to change their beliefs. That's why St. Jude said we need to contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. At the San Antonio Worldview Conference, Confessional Lutherans Jonathan Fisk, Jay Weber, Ryan McPherson, and Craig Parton will unmask the false, direct us to Christ and His Word, and defend the faith. The San Antonio Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 11th, San Antonio, Texas. Visit worldviewsa.org. worldusa.org.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Issues Etc. offered post-election analysis from a variety of perspectives. Former U.S. Attorney General Ed Meese.
By giving a list of the type of people that he would appoint as judges, it gave a number of people confidence that A. President Trump would be very cognizant of the importance of constitutional appointments to the court.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I am hopeful, though, that his appointees and also the Republican Congress will push for and enact protections for people who happen to have religious convictions on these matters so that they won't be simply driven out of society.
Journalist Molly Hemingway.
The media are so far removed from actual people who don't live in Washington or New York, that they were unable to see what was going on, even though people were trying pretty hard to convey their feelings here.
Social critic Aaron Wolf.
If they're serious about curbing abortion, we need to hold their feet to the fire on this, because they now have a signature from the president that they should be able to get, and therefore they are without excuse when it comes to these things.
And never Trumper, Dr. Frank Beckwith.
The accusation of racism, I think, is just a cheap slur. And of course, these people can't defend themselves. And here comes Donald Trump, and he says, I'll stand by you. I will be your advocate. And it explained to me why people gravitated to this man. And it's somebody who I did not support myself, but I think I understand much better now.
Your comprehensive source for news, information, and truth, issues, etc. Issues, etc. Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian is brought to you today in part by Concordia University Wisconsin Online. They offer 50 online educational options for an associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree. Find out more by clicking the Concordia University Wisconsin Online logo at issuesetc.org. They'll even waive your application fee when you enter the program code ISSUES. Concordia University Wisconsin Online. We're talking about some statements made on 60 Minutes by President-elect Donald Trump on abortion and homosexual marriage. Hadley Arkus is our guest professor emeritus of jurisprudence and American institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act and the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truths, the Touchstone of the Natural Law. Hadley, we've had a 40-year lesson since Roe v. Wade in advocating for the protections of the unborn under the umbrella of that Supreme Court decision. Is there a lesson there for those who want to protect family and marriage going forward under the umbrella of Obergefell?
No, I don't think it's possible. I think once you accept the premises of Obergefell, then everything else falls into place. And in fact, they couldn't explain in Obergefell why it would be confined to, marriage would be confined to two people. In fact, that is one of the things we would try to bring back in the first move to counter Obergefell. I mean, after all, if it's simply a matter of an intimate, loving relationship, recognizing the autonomy of people to declare whom they love and to declare that that love is so deep that it must be manifested in a marriage. And once you accept that, then you're really quite open to the argument, well, why can't the rest of us marry the ones we love? And our love isn't confined to a coupling. We love a couple of other people. We have what Time Magazine says we have 50,000 polyamorous households in the country, people living in sexual relations in a group of three, four, and more. We're likely to see polygamy come unless the court's putting polygamy into place by saying, well, listen, your people are cohabiting all over the country. You're enforcing the laws on cohabitation only against Mormons, by God, so it's a religious discrimination. Or if you just take Obergefell on its own terms, as John Roberts complained in the case, as the rest of us have been arguing for 20 years, there is no way that this decision would preclude polygamy, which is why we'd suggest that the first crack at this thing, the first move to counter it, is the move to do a version of Kerry Severino's Defense of Monogamous Marriage Act, to do the Defense of Marriage Act again in a way by saying the federal government need not be obliged to regard as a marriage a union involving more than two people, and the state need not be obliged to respect a marriage coming in from abroad of more than two people. And if he could do that, that would show, that simple measure would show, the political branches can come in to counter and limit what the court has decided. And if they could do that, they may be able to come back with another decision that says whatever is meant by Obergefell, it certainly could not have meant the right of a father to marry his adult son or the mother to marry her adult daughter, or brothers to marry brothers, sisters to marry sisters. And then you could say, well, what got us here in the first place? It's not the very premises of Obergefell. But I don't see, we could work taking Obergefell and start cutting back on it, but you'd have to challenge its premises. And just that we'd have to challenge the very premises of Roe, but we don't know when human life begins or what constitutes human life. But it would have to be one of those moves in which we raise these questions that keep striking at the reasoning, at the principle that lay at the heart of the opinion itself.
You mentioned earlier, I think it was Anthony Kennedy who wrote for Obergefell, that, and you mentioned this kind of the only reason anyone would oppose these same-sex marriages is some sort of religious animus.
Irrational animus.
Do we need to deal with that, or is he better off ignored?
Well, my complaint about the conservative judges is that they never dealt with it. My dear friend Samuel Alito said in one of, I think it was Opinion of the Windsor case, that, well, after all, there are arguments. Robert George has an argument about a book about what is marriage. On the other side, Jonathan Rauch has a book in defense of same-sex marriage. But Justice Alito never drew out the arguments. The conservative judges have been content to float on the surface in this way by saying, the Constitution says nothing about marriage, therefore the judges have no ground to proclaim any kind of constitutional right dealing with marriage, and therefore we have nothing to say. We return the matter to the political arena. But of course, the Constitution said nothing about marriage when they did Loving versus Virginia in 1967 and struck down those laws in Virginia and other places that barred marriage across racial lines. And the same thing here. It wasn't enough simply to say the Constitution says nothing about it. One side was making the argument that the denial of this right of same-sex marriage is a denial of autonomy and affront to dignity. And that moral argument, specious as it was never answered until even just the beginning of in Obergefell, John Roberts started making a move in that direction. But those arguments were never countered by judges drawing on the deep case to make the moral argument as to why marriage of a man and woman was indeed a defensible form of marriage, the most defensible form of marriage. So one side was making a moral argument, and under the current conventions that characterize conservative jurisprudence, even the jurisprudence of my dear late friend Justice Scalia, under the conventions that mark conservative jurisprudence, the conservative judges would never make the moral argument. They'd simply say, we rely on some mechanistic test. It's not in the Constitution, therefore we have nothing to declare. And then they simply complain about raw judicial power. But in the meantime, one side is making a moral argument, and that argument has been left mainly unanswered by the conservative side. And I think as we go into these years with Donald Trump, we have to say, I think we could say, take that line from Herman Cain and say, how has that been working for us? You know, people do conservative jurisprudence, say this is a more cautious, prudent, safer way of dealing with the law to avoid judicial excess. We'd say, no, it has not been safe. It has not been prudent. It's been a loser. It's been a persistent loser. And we are in a situation now of a serious culture war with an attack on religious institutions. I can imagine... we can imagine the federal government requiring private Christian schools to have outreach to LGBT groups, and that could put many of these Christian schools out of business, and Donald Trump says he's okay with that? I mean, we're in the middle of a culture war, and the conservative side just is not stepping into it. We're sort of just hoping judges will save us from it, helping some mechanistic test of the Constitution will do without the need to engage in any substantive argument about the rights and wrongs of this matter. Well, imagine that, a law in which we can deal with questions of legal right and wrong by never getting into the actual rights, substantive rights and wrongs of the matter. And the law that legal argument proceeds in that way is just a legal argument that is wanting at the core. One thing at the heart of things. So the question is, are we going to keep proceeding in that path? Or is something going to jostle us out of that and finally induce conservatives in the Congress and in the courts to start moving into a different mode of making the substantive arguments?
With about a minute here, Hadley, if President-elect Donald Trump sought your legal expertise on...
Well, if he did, I don't think that's going to happen.
Just play along. If he sought your legal expertise on Obergefell and Roe, with about a minute, what would you say to him?
I say there are very... The problem began with the center from the national level. It was the Supreme Court that injected this issue into our national politics. The problem, the remedy has to come from the center in a series of small measures incrementally to teach different lessons by planting premises. You have it readily within your power to do it. Lincoln did it. FDR did it. Other people have done it. You can do it just as well. It is not beyond your reach. It's not beyond imagining. It's simpler than you think if you only reach out and do it.
Hadley Arkus is Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, author of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, and author of the book Constitutional Illusions and Anchoring Truth, The Touchstone of Natural Law. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. It is always a pleasure, and thank you so much for your time, Hadley.
Oh, listen, thanks. It's a privilege to be on Todd. Thanks for inviting me and letting me expatiate here and proclaim and argue as I did. Thanks so much again.
Tomorrow on Issues, etc., we're going to find out why Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard calls Hillary Clinton the Lady Ghostbusters of the presidential candidates. And on Thursday, we'll continue our series, Setting the Lord's Table, talking with Pastor Will Wheaton about some things that you, well, I hope you see every Sunday. If you walk into a church that practices the historic liturgy, you're going to see all kinds of furniture up there in the chancel. You may know the name of some of them. You may not know the names of others. They all have a purpose, and we'll find out what they are and what their purpose is Thursday on Issues, etc., talking about liturgical furniture. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening. I'll talk with you tomorrow on Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performance Fitness 618.com.